It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, today we're moving across the Pacific into new grilling territory, to Japan. There's a different starting point there. When you've always lived with limited resources and fuel, you learn that little pieces cook faster than big pieces. So you conjure up all sorts of ways of knocking out great-tasting bits of food. Then you lace them on skewers for easy handling. You give them only a few minutes on the grill, because that's all they need, and you have a yakitori party. That's what this kind of grilling is called in Japan. So stay with us for the Japanese grill experts and lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In food writer world, you're supposed to swear off two things. First, never use an adjective when a good verb is around. And second, never ever say mouth-watering or tasty. So I'm in deep trouble because when I look at today's lineup, all I can think of is mouth-watering and tasty. I mean, we've got a home beer maker with a technique that's incredibly simple and a great recipe. We've got two guys who do dynamite Japanese grilling. The Stearns have found great food on an off-ramp in Connecticut. And executive wine editor over at Food & Wine magazine, Ray Isle, is joining us. Ray, welcome.
It's great to be back, Lynn. Thanks.
So, Ray, I want to talk about wines and grilling. Now, usually, you know, when you start hitting the grill, it's more beer territory.
It is beer territory.
But it's challenging because we tend to have a lot of extreme flavors when we hit the grill. And I think it kind of throws the wine lovers off a bit. So, for instance, okay, what would you pair with hot dogs that you serve with onions and sauerkraut and relish, you know, with the works?
Yeah, with onions, sauerkraut, relish, maybe some cheese, some chili.
Exactly. I mean, that's a nightmare for a wine, isn't it?
It is, in a sense. I mean, when you get something like that, and it's a lot of grilled food. It's not that different from a hamburger with all the trimmings. You've got a whole lot of different flavors piled into one bite of food. And what I tend to go for in that instance is I tend to go for red wines because they have a little more robustness to them. And I tend to go for something that has a lot of fruit intensity but not necessarily a lot of tannins. Just a big, rich, powerful red. For instance, Malbec, which has become incredibly popular over the past few years. The Crios de Susana Balbo Malbec, I think, is a fantastic wine.
That slowly, Ray.
Crios de Susana Balbo Malbec. Okay. But on the other hand, you can also stick to California. And Mike Dash, it's D-A-S-H-E, makes a fantastic Dry Creek Valley Zinfandel that's one of my every summer go-to cookout wines. You know, it'll go with a hot dog with all trimmings, go to hamburger with all the trimmings. Anything you can put trimmings on, it'll go with it.
Okay. So would you chill your reds in the summer?
You know, I like to serve them definitely cooler than, you know, 95 degrees or something like that if you happen to be out in the sun. You know, cellar temperature for wine is typically around 60 degrees, and that's for red wines. Uh-huh. I like serving red wines at home a little cooler than room temperature, too. It tends to bring out the flavor and kind of tame the tannins a little bit. Especially if you get lighter reds like Pinot Noir, Beaujolais, you can really chill those down quite a bit, and they're terrific. You know, it's just more refreshing in the summer.
Okay, I've got some tough ones for you.
Right? Okay.
I mean, the things that normally you never serve with wine.
I'm ready.
chicken with a jalapeno marinade.
Yeah.
Like a jerk chicken.
Tear your head off chicken.
You got it. Exactly.
I would go, you know, with anything that spicy, I tend to go with something, a wine that actually has a little bit of sweetness to it, a little bit of off-dry sweetness. So one of my favorite go-tos is the Eroica Riesling out of Washington State. It's from Chateau Saint Michel and a combination with a German winemaker, but it's got that beautiful bright fruit, good acidity, and it's got that little tiny bit of sweetness. It's not obtrusive, but when you've also got, you know, crazily hot peppers in your mouth, it's a good combination. If you wanted to go red, I'd actually go with something red and sparkling like Lambrusco. which I think is a great go-to with really spicy foods if you want something red. It's Lambruscas are kind of coming back in.
How about charred eggplant?
Charred eggplant. Well, anytime you've got char, you've got a little bit of smokiness, and I like to pair something that has a kind of, you know, goes along with it in terms of the smoky realm. So I'd probably go for something like Shiraz or Syrah, which are the same grape, in fact. You know, a good Shiraz out of Australia would be a good one. Penfolds, you know, any of the good Penfolds wines, Bin 28 Shiraz, that would be a fantastic pairing with that. If you wanted to go white, I probably would go, I'd actually stick to the Rhone varieties. I'd do something like the Marsan from Coupe in California, which is a beautiful, beautiful white wine that's not terribly expensive. Coupe's terrific producer, and that would be yummy with eggplant, charred or not.
let's go kind of down the road a bit to that. The sticky sweet kind of things, you know, you can brush them on the ribs or they're going to go on something, even on vegetables.
Yeah. With sticky and sweet, I go two ways with that. One, you can go kind of fruity but not sweet. I think sometimes if you've got a sweet glaze and you go with a sweet wine as well, it gets a bit overpowering and dessert-like. So what I like is something light and fruity, and what I like is dry rosé, which has had a huge, you know, resurgence in recent years.
Yeah.
But rather than kind of the classic Provençal, which is pretty lean, I'd actually go with something from either Spain or the New World because it tends to be fruitier and more kind of, you get that beautiful strawberry watermelon kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
something like the Tepeña Rosé out of Spain, which is a Grenache blend, or actually the Etude makes a fantastic rosé from Pinot Noir out of California. And that would be, you know, it's got the flavor of red wine, but it doesn't have the tannin, so it's going to go well with something like shrimp or seafood.
It's
got fruitiness, so it'll work with the sweetness, but it won't overpower your mouth with too much sticky sweetness. And they're great in the summer, too, because you chill them down, and they take a chill just as well as a white wine.
Yeah. So, Ray, one last challenge. What would you serve with Ruffles?
Potato chips. I have the perfect pairing with potato chips, which is champagne. or any kind of dry sparkling wine. There's something about sparkling wine and saltiness. Salty snacks go great with sparkling wine. And I can, you know, point a finger at any sommelier around the world and they'll say potato chips or French fries and sparkling wine is a fantastic combination. You know, sparkling wines, even when they're dry, have a little tiny bit of sweetness to them. And that paired with that salt is just fantastic.
Okay.
And plus it's fun, which is important. You know?
Yeah, I like the idea. Living large.
Yeah, I think you should set up a big movie screen outside, you know, get your potato chips and your champagne, invite a bunch of friends over and have fun.
I love it. I love it. Hey, Ray, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Ray Isle is executive wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. Now, Ray's wine picks are on the website, as is a recipe to pair with them. Cumin lemon lamb grill in lettuce rolls. It's all at splendidtable.org. Michael Stern have this job. They track down good eats, local eats around the country. And no, they do not need anyone to carry their bags. Jane, Michael, right. What's the latest adventure?
Lynn, I had the most wonderful road food experience. I actually found a place on my own without Michael and had the honor of taking him there and showing him this fabulous diner, the Lakeside Diner in Stamford, Connecticut, that has, without a doubt, the best pancakes in the state of Connecticut.
And great, great donuts. And let me just say,
you're taking over.
No, let me just say.
This is my fault.
Out of respect for Jane, I had driven past this restaurant maybe 500 times in the last several years and never noticed it.
Where is your sense of exploration, Michael?
I was always on my way to somewhere else. And the fact is, if you're traveling along the Merritt Parkway in Connecticut, which is a major thoroughfare, you get off at exit 34 and it's there. It is exactly at the end of the exit ramp. You can't miss it. And
it's a tiny little place, and it has the great diner hours of, I forget if it's 7 a.m. or 8 a.m., till 2 p.m. And that's when you know a diner is great.
Because they're not wasting their time on anything
else. No, and they've
else.
Sold everything out that they've made for the day. And
so what's it
home.
Called? What's it called?
It's called the Lakeside Diner, and that name is not an affectation because even though it is a diner with diner prices and a diner menu, there is a whole wall of seats at a picture window that looks out over this beautiful lake. It's like you're in the country somewhere, and yet there's the Merritt Parkway a few hundred yards behind you.
But you know what? I really don't care about the lake. I care about the donuts.
Yeah.
They make such wonderful Yankee-style donuts, meaning not crispy cream-type grease.
Cake donuts.
Yeah, like fried cake donuts, but that have no taste of old oil in them. Simple, plain, angelic, and rather small. They're maybe the size of your fist.
Uh-huh.
Well,
you have a big fist.
If you were pretty hungry, a half dozen would be a good snack. You get off, get a half dozen, and drive on into New York, and by the time you get there, you're done.
But the blueberry pancakes, I'm sorry, that
no, the blueberry pancakes are out of this world.
They're a foot across. They're paper thin or pancake thin. Fresh blueberries. If you order a whole stack, you won't have to eat for the rest of the day. And great veteran waitresses. I was going to say old waitresses, but they'd smack me if they ever saw me again.
And they would.
These women, they're not kids who are just hired, you know, on their college summer break. These are waitresses who've been diner waitresses for 25, 30 years. And they are just, God, they're perfect.
How big is this place?
Pretty small. Actually, if you go there on a weekend, you'll have to wait for a table.
I think there's like 10 tables, 10 little
maybe
tables.
Maybe 10 tables, a short counter.
With little stools.
With stools, of course.
But small. Like, it's a very small place, and it does get extremely crowded. You know, you take it in life in your hands if you go there on a Sunday morning. But it's worth the wait, and it's just one of these classic New England diners that are just getting so hard to find.
This sounds really like one of those great places you look for when you're on a road trip.
Exactly.
The only thing I would recommend, because I'm sort of a purist, I bring my own bottle of maple syrup because I like real maple syrup. And this place doesn't charge enough to serve real maple syrup. But aside from that, it is the best.
Bring it in a hip flask, right?
Yeah. Jane has a maple syrup holster that she carries all the time.
I should. And a butter holster.
Yeah, well, I'm with you. Hey, Jane, thank you for the discovery. And Michael, I think you were very gracious.
And thank you, Jane. And Lynn.
You're welcome. Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern's new book is The Lexicon of Real American Food. And for their very latest eating finds, go to their website, splendidtable.org. Now, at that very same website, you will find podcasts, recipes, and you could register for our monthly book giveaway. You know where to go, splendidtable.org. More is coming up, Japanese grilling and how the wild and crazy corn cob was tamed. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Right about this time every year, my grilling repertoire begins to fade. We've done the classic barbecue blasts of the 4th, the ribs, the burgers, the hot dogs. Time for a fresh take. Enter New York chef Tadashi Ono and journalist Haris Salat, authors of The Japanese Grill, from classic yakitori to steak, seafood, and vegetables. Tadashi, Haris, welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
So, Tadashi, in Japan, do the Japanese grill the way we do? You know, I'm thinking we come home and we grill after work or grill for parties.
Well, no, Japan, you know, has a small apartment and house doesn't have a garden. So mainly grilling stuff we're buying from around the corner. There's a lot of yakitori joint in the neighborhood. So
it's mainly something that you get from a restaurant or from a takeout
place?
Right,
it's mainly like restaurant food, yes, correct.
Ah, so Harris, you look at this from an American point of view.
A hungry American's point of view, yes.
What do you see as the difference between Japanese grilling and American kind of grilling?
Well, I mean, I think on a fundamental level, Japan, of course, is a chopstick culture. So, you know, even in a restaurant, you're not going to find like a big grilled steak or pork chops or lamb chops. Foods are sliced, they're skewered. Shaved meat is used a lot for grilling. So, as you said in your introduction, that you can, you know, get the kind of essence of flavor by just quickly grilling like a thin piece of richly marbled beef or something like that. So that's really, you know, one of the big differences. And, you know, as Tadashi just said, too, that people typically don't have homes where they can have like live fire cooking. So, but there's live fire cooking everywhere in Japan because it's one of the fundamental ways to cook food in Japanese cuisine.
Tadashi, you mentioned yakitori. Now, is yakitori the term for grilled food?
Yes, it really means a grilled chicken, but skewered meat or skewered vegetable, all kinds of skewered things we could call yakitori.
Let's do this. Could you break down how the grilling is done? For instance, how you set up a grill for yakitori.
Sure. One of the things that's so interesting for Tadashi and I mean, we sat there and we thought, okay, you know, what yakitori is you're grilling skewers and you're turning the skewers often. And how do you do that on a Weber? Because, you know, of course, you can go and buy a specialized Japanese grill that's just exactly the right width for skewers. But, you know, we wanted to think about what you can do for, you know, in your backyard anywhere in America with what you got. And, you know, that's where we came up with this idea of wrapping bricks in foil. That was actually Tadashi's inspiration. And creating these kind of two rows of foil-wrapped bricks on top of your grate. And the bricks are just wide enough that you can rest a skewer between them. And actually, they're a little far off the fire, so the chicken or whatever you're skewering isn't going to burn. But then there's a whole process of cooking the yakitori skewers, and it's pretty ingenious. So maybe the maestro can explain it a little bit more.
Well, first you grill without any sauce to dry it up a little bit. Then you dip into the sauce. Then all this dried up part sucks the sauce into it. So then you caramelize it afterwards. So it's really a good way to cook things.
There's also, you mentioned something about there's a special charcoal that if you can afford it, you like to use it.
It's a binchotan.
What is that? What is
that's
this?
Harris knows.
Well, binchotan is really interesting. It is a very special charcoal. It's a very traditional charcoal, and it's actually used within the Japanese tea ceremony. There's a role for binchotan to heat water for tea. And so kind of the, you know, the center point of Japanese culture, it's part of that. And it's also an amazing material that's used by chefs in Japan, and it is very special. It's a certain kind of oak. I mean, the kind of the original binchotan is a certain kind of oak that's turned into charcoal in an earthen kiln. It takes over a week for that process to be completed in one little part of Japan by artisans that are now, you know, passing away and the art's starting to become lost a little bit. But at the end of it, what you have is this incredibly hard charcoal that looks like branches of trees that it was, you know, a week ago. And it's so hard that if you clink it together, it clinks like glass, or like you knock it together, it clinks like glass.
Huh.
The thing that's so amazing about this charcoal is that, first of all, it burns incredibly hot, something like 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit hot.
Whoa.
And it burns smokeless and odorless and can go for hours. And what that does is creates just a totally different way of passing heat through food. And Japanese chefs say that, you know, it really helps develop the umami within food just by the way the heat passes through food.
Correct.
And also, maybe because it's so hot, it doesn't dry out the foods? I don't know.
It cooks it very short times, and it doesn't dry out much. and it cooks through very fast too.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah,
it's amazing stuff.
It is amazing.
You don't need to have a lot of this charcoal. You can have
like a couple of
very
sticks.
Very less. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an incredibly beautiful picture in the book of something I never thought of doing. It's a picture of grilled rice.
Yeah.
What is this?
Well, it's called yaki onigiri, and it's grilled rice balls. And, like caramelized rice, crusty rice is really delicious, of course. And so here you can make it on the grill. And you can brush on some soy sauce or do it with a little bit of miso. So you add some flavor and savoriness. And then you have this just wonderful experience of crunching through, the outer shell of the rice and then having the tender rice inside.
Mm. So is this rice ball something that's traditional in Japan and you would serve it as part of your grilled meal?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, a Japanese meal is not, appetizer, main course, dessert. It's a lot of different dishes. It's kind of a procession of a lot of different plates. And we think about a grilling meal also to kind of have fun and cook a lot of different things. And having grilled rice balls as part of it is, should be part of every grilled meal. It's delicious.
I could not agree with you more. Guys, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Tadashi Ono and Harris Salat are authors of The Japanese Grill. Now, their recipe for that grilled rice cake, yaki onigiri, is on the website, splendidtable.org. While we're considering small grilled things, let's think about small batches of delicious brewed things. William Bostwick and his partner Jesse Reimel figured out how to make pretty swell beer in a tiny apartment kitchen on an equally tiny budget. And they did it the usual way. They made a lot of mistakes and learned a lot of tricks. Well, they include all those tricks in their book, Beercraft, A Simple Guide to Making Great Beer. William Bostwick is here. William, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
The first question that comes to mind, it really begins with a quote. Because somebody once said, beware of any venture that requires new clothes. My question is, what is it going to cost me to start making beer? I mean, what do I need to begin?
Well, an apron helps with the clothes part.
Okay, there's maybe $5 right there. Okay.
The way we did it, Jesse and I did it, we are a little bit gear averse. We wanted to find a way to make beer that wouldn't require us going to the hardware store and, building a brewery in our kitchen. So the most complicated piece of equipment we really use is a stock pot. And if you have a big soup pot, you're well on your way to making beer.
You mean that's it?
Well, I mean, of course, there are a couple kind of specialized gadgets, some plastic tubing, a bottle capper, some airlocks, but for the most part, if you have a 1 gallon jug, we just use an old cider jug, and if you have a big stock pot, you're pretty much set. It cost us, I would say, about $40 or $50 to really fully stock our stovetop brewery. But once you make that initial investment, it's every recipe you make, maybe $5-$10.
Oh, that's not bad. And how much beer do you get for $5 or $10?
We brew 1 gallon at a time. Most other home brewing books out there are geared towards 5 gallons.
That's a lot of beer to drink.
it's a lot of beer to drink. It's also a lot to keep in a tiny apartment kitchen like ours. So we really needed something that we could do easily on a low power apartment stove.
Yeah.
And something that wouldn't require us emptying out our pantry to store 50 bottles of beer at a time.
Also, when I think about it, $5 is a little more than a dollar a quart. That's not too bad.
Yeah, it's not that bad.
So could you pick a recipe from the book and then take us through the basic steps of making a beer?
Sure. So the recipe we most recently brewed is a saison. And that's actually the first recipe that Jesse and I made when we were working on the book that really came together. the first thing we made where we realized, you know, we can make great beer in our kitchen. A saison is a Belgian-style beer, similar a little bit to a wheat beer. It's kind of light and summery. It's really great beer for this time of year. So the way it works is you get your grain. For the saison recipe, we use mostly barley malt, a little bit of wheat, and it's a couple pounds total. And then you put all those grains in a big mesh bag, like a giant tea bag, basically.
Okay.
And you steep it in a pot of hot water for an hour. And what that does is extracts all the sugars in the grain that are then going to ferment and turn into beer.
Oh.
So you steep that in hot water, and then after an hour, kind of lift the bag out. All the, you know, good syrupy, sweet proto beer will drain out. And then that's, it's called wort at that point. And then you boil it, add your hops or whatever kind of spices you're going to use to flavor it. In the case of this saison, it's just hops, although you can get really creative like we like to do and put peppercorns or different fruits and spices, that kind of stuff in there. You boil it for about an hour, and that sanitizes it, so the only thing that is going to ferment it is the yeast that you add. And it also extracts all the, you know, bitter flavors from the hops that you add. After you boil it, you cool it down, put it into a 1 gallon jug, and add your yeast and ferment it. And then it's beer.
That's it?
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, then of course you put it in bottles, and then wait for the bottles to carbonate. The whole process takes about a month for the saison.
So it's really a very simple process.
Yeah, you know, you can get really into it. You can kind of geek out over a lot of the elements. You can take a kind of scientific bent to it. We prefer, I guess, a little bit more of an artistic route. We get very creative with our recipes. We get creative with designing labels for the bottles that we make. And you can still make really great beer. You know, you don't have to worry too much about all the ins and outs of, hydrometer readings and maltose levels and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you can, and it's fun, but you don't have to.
How long will it keep?
The thing about homebrew is that it's kind of a living thing. You know, there's still live yeast in the bottle, and it's unpasteurized, obviously. So it'll keep. The stronger the beer is, for the most part, the longer it will keep. I just had a barley wine that a friend of mine brewed 5 years ago. I had it the other day, and that was still absolutely fantastic.
Wow.
Maybe even better than it was when you first made it. But, you know, the saison, for example, or a lighter beer like a wheat beer or an IPA, you know, those you should really drink fresh. And, you know, that's something that you can only really experience when you make beer yourself, you know, as fresh as possible.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
William Bostwick is co-author of Beercraft, A Simple Guide to Making Great Beer. Now, that beer recipe for saison, it's on the website. Splendidtable.org. If you've read The Omnivore's Dilemma, you know that we're a nation built on corn. It's our food, and it's a big part of our wealth. The Americas gave corn to the world. But here's the intriguing part. Those corn chips you're munching right now, they have a family tree that trumps yours and mine by about 8,000 years. This is a siren song for Dr. Bruce D. Smith. He's the senior research scientist and curator of North American archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution. Dr. Smith, welcome.
It's great to be here.
So, Bruce, where did corn really begin?
Corn began maybe 8,000 to 10,000 years ago in south central Mexico when human populations, human societies in the region brought a wild grass called teosinte and started cultivating it, started planting it, harvesting it, storing the seeds, and then planting it in subsequent years. And this resulted in some real responses to that harvesting and planting by the wild grass itself, which resulted pretty quickly in a lot of the characteristics we see in modern corn.
This is the thing, though. You're saying it was a grass. It started out as a wild grass.
Correct.
How did humans figure out that this was the grass they wanted to cultivate, as opposed to who knows how many other kinds of grasses that would have been around?
Right. Very good question. I guess the answer to that is difficult. I would argue that beginning about 10,000 years ago, all over the world, because the climate and environments were settling down and becoming more resource-rich, humans started fooling around with a wide range of different species of plants and animals to see which ones might respond to manipulation or intervention in their life cycle by humans. So humans were auditioning all kinds of plants and animals, and some of them they could see had real potential for turning into a good food source, and they focused on those. And maize was one of those.
You refer to this, if I remember, in one of your papers as the Neolithic Revolution.
Correct.
So across the world, people who have nothing to do with each other, they've had no communication, are all starting to experiment with what we would call agriculture, right?
Right. We know of at least 10 and perhaps a dozen independent centers of initial domestication of plants and animals in all different parts of the world, and in Asia and Africa and a number of places in the Americas, including Eastern North America, where human societies that had no interaction with each other were experimenting and domesticating those plants or animals in their particular region that were sort of pre-adapted or susceptible to domestication.
And they were perfecting them to make them easier to grow, having more food, giving them more return for their effort.
Exactly. That's the underlying cause worldwide, or the underlying purpose worldwide, is to get a more reliable, more dependable, more predictable sources of food.
Uh-huh. Bruce, this is fascinating. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Bruce D. Smith is Senior Research Scientist and Curator of North American Archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution. Now, for yet another stage in corn's evolution, check out our recipe for drippy Mexican sweet corn. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, this week's trivia challenge is up. Now, the question is, where can you eat a horseshoe? We're going to be back with that answer, and we will be opening up the lines for your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, email us, splendidtable.org, or call us, 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, where can you eat a horseshoe? Well, the answer is that the only place you can eat a horseshoe is in Springfield, Missouri. Now, in fact, it was first conjured up at the Leyland Hotel in 1928. The horseshoe is a big plate piled with food. The first layer is usually hamburgers or pork or fried chicken or maybe a mix of all of them. And then it's topped with about 2 pounds of French fries and then a gorgeous silky cheese sauce. Now, of course, there are many permutations of this dish. The Stearns talk about it in their book, The Lexicon of Real American Food. It's a dish that serious food lovers would never eat until nobody's looking.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid. Just call me.
It is time to get in touch. The lines are open. We are talking with you. Anything goes. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Follow us on Twitter or friend us on Facebook. Kent's calling from Nashville. Kent, hi, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing?
I am doing swell. How about you?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you so much. I am a huge fan of making quite a few dishes that I've noticed all have one thing in common, and that is pork shoulder. And I love to make carnitas. I'm being from Memphis originally, I'm a huge fan of a good smoky pork shoulder. And so I've sort of been working up this idea in my brain for quite some time, and it seems like it should work really well, but I wanted to run the gist of it by you and see if you can tell me where pitfalls might be or if you think it would work.
Okay, I'm ready.
Basically, the idea was if I were to do normally carnitas, it's essentially just sort of a confit. A kind of an approach.
Yeah, you cook and cook and cook the pork shoulder.
Right.
Until it's almost falling apart, right?
Indeed. You do it in lard and just very low and slow. And typically what you do once after you've cooked it for quite some time, then you bring the lard up in temperature so that you crisp everything up.
Yeah.
Well, as opposed to doing that, I thought, well, what if I were to take it about maybe two-thirds of the way and basically just sort of a confit method and then take that out instead of breaking it up like you normally would and crisping it, then take it to the smoker and smoke it for a few hours. I figure it's going to be awfully, awfully tender, so I would think it would hold up and not dry out too much. And then after smoking it, take it and create sort of a more of a rub than a glaze, but sort of an ancho chili powder, chipotle chili powder, cumin, honey, sea salt, little vinegar.
Right, right. Okay, so essentially a glaze, a sauce. Yeah.
Exactly. And then throw it on a grill. Chop it into pieces, throw it on a grill really briefly, just a couple minutes.
Right.
Take all that fat and everything else and get it incredibly crispy on the outside with this glaze. But I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think it's an excellent idea. And the idea of a confit, which is where you actually cook something in its own fat. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people first might rub it with some kind of seasoning. And, and with doing that with a pork shoulder already has a lot of great marbling. So that means moisture is on your side with this. And I think the key is going to be cook it in the lard long enough for it to be just about cooked through, but that it still can hold its shape. Because in that long smoking, which is going to be low temperature but constant, it's going to continue to cook. And you don't want it to cook to the point where the meat no longer has taste or where it's totally falling apart. It still has to hold together. So the key is, essentially, it's almost like trying to maintain an interior temperature of about 160 of the chunks of meat. Mm-hmm. But the idea of first cooking it in the lard, and if I were you, you season your lard, and I mean it's cooking in something
right.
with a right. Correct. I would leave it in the fridge overnight in that after that first step because it's going to absorb all of that flavor. Then the next, and this gives you leeway, the next day you can do the smoking. And if you want, the next day is when you finish it off, which means if you're having people over or whatever, that's when you glaze it and do that number on it. But it's already been, partially cooked and then it's been smoked. Mm-hmm. I think you're home free, but just be careful not to overcook it.
Okay, that's a great idea.
And I think that idea can be stretched. You can vary that in a lot of ways in terms of the mixture that you cook it in. It doesn't have to be fat. It could be, it could be chipotle and adobo and orange juice and a ton of garlic and, water or broth or wine.
Right.
You see, and then go to the smoker and then go to the glaze. And you could do it with anything, chicken, whatever. But I think pork shoulder, I'm with you. I think that's a great piece of meat.
It's really hard to beat.
Yeah. Hey, I think this is a great idea. Give it a shot. It's going to work. It's going to be dynamite.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You enjoy.
right.
Bye, Kent. There are cuts that are so forgiving that you really can't kill them short of overcooking them to death, and that is anything from the shoulder, pork shoulder, chuck roast, that kind of thing. You're home free. Just don't let it get overcooked and you're done. Anyway, 800-537-5252 or connect with us on Facebook. We've got Martha calling from Boston. Martha, what do you want to talk about?
I'm trying to figure out how you wash blackberries. They seem to get waterlogged.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay. You wash blackberries the way you wash mushrooms, fast.
Okay.
Yeah. No, but this is the idea. You put it into a big bowl of water or a sink full of cold water. You gently swish it around, and then you quickly take it out and get it into a sieve or a colander. Mm-hmm. You don't want it having moisture remaining on it because it's going to start to deteriorate.
Okay.
And you never wash fruit until just before you're going to use it.
Right.
Because it just starts to go. You know,
right.
It moisture is the enemy of almost anything with that's leafy or fruit because it starts to go down.
Okay.
But that's the best way to do it. And let it spread it out in the colander. Let it sit. Let them sit so they can thoroughly drain.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks. I love your show.
Hey, thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for calling. Lydia's on the line from Iowa City. Lydia, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about fresh oregano. I am inundated with the stuff. It grows about 3 times faster than all my other herbs, and I don't know what to do with all of it. So I was wondering if you could suggest anything where fresh oregano is sort of the main event rather than chopped up and sprinkled on there.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I know what you mean, by the way, because there was there were a couple of years when my herb garden was going full bore. I had never seen a plant spread. I thought mint spread. This, yeah.
Yeah.
It was turning up in the garage at one point. You know.
Exactly.
But this is the thing, because oregano is strong. It's not like basil, you know, where you can use it by the handful. It's pretty
right.
strong.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Okay, there's a classic combination of oregano and capers and garlic and lemon zest.
Ooh.
Yeah, and a little olive oil. And that combination is really kind of neat because you can rub it on almost anything. It's unbelievable on lamb, but it's great on eggplant. It's good. You know, when you grill onions,
mm-hmm.
you put some of that on top of it. You mix it. Use that as a topping for a sliced tomato salad. It's just fabulous.
Okay.
I'm just thinking of condiments you can make with it because it's pretty powerful. The other thing I think what I would do is wash it well, let it dry completely, you know, on a drain board or whatever so it's not wet. Strip the leaves and freeze them because I don't have any way of telling you how to use the amount you've probably got right now.
Yeah.
But remember, it works brilliantly in Mexican food. Obviously, you know, yeah, because oregano, granted, it's Mexican oregano. It's a slightly different beast than probably the one you have. But you can get away with it. So that means it's great with any beans. It's wonderful with things with chili. Like if you want to make a classic chili salsa, you take dried red chilies, you soak them in warm water. And then what you do, you take off the stems. If you want to, you seed them, drain them, put them in a blender with garlic, oregano, and a little fresh water and salt and pepper. You puree that, and you've got the beginning of a salsa.
Oh, wow.
But I would say freeze a pile of it. You're going to be able to use it all winter. You will have enough to get you through until next summer.
I am sure I will. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Lydia. Enjoy the oregano.
I will. Bye.
The thing about oregano, by the way, it comes in a lot of forms. There's Greek, there's Mexican, there's Mediterranean, there's French, there's Lord knows what. But it is a pretty powerful herb. So when you plant it, plant very, very little and know it comes back every year in most cases. 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. That brilliant peach-flavored iced tea that you like so much, that bottle may have never seen a peach. All that, in quotes, you know, natural peach taste could have been created in a lab by someone called a flavorist. A lot of what we enjoy eating is good because a scientist was trained for some maybe 10 years to make that food taste like it just came from the tree or from grandma's kitchen.
Well, John Wright is a flavorist with several decades behind him of conjuring tastes. John, welcome.
Hi.
So, okay, how do you create that wonderful peach flavor?
Well, the first step is to try and find out what nature has done. So we're not proud. We steal every secret that we can from nature. We analyze the peach or whatever the target is using gas chromatography, a lot of advanced techniques to try and identify each individual component in the natural food. And then we try and take those ideas, and we don't necessarily copy exactly because we think that some elements of flavors are more attractive than others. So we try and make the flavor as attractive to the particular market as we possibly can.
All right, but can you walk me through doing the peach?
Yeah.
You know, kind of step by step, how you find all those components and what they are?
Sure. Peach is relatively simple because you're just looking at a fruit. So your first step would be to find the ideal peach. There is, of course, no such thing, but you get as close as you can. So you try and look to an heirloom variety. You try and look to the ideal growing conditions, and you try to look to ideal ripeness, something that you may not actually find in a supermarket because of all the commercial considerations. Then, within that peach, there will be a whole range of components that are present at very, very low levels. They're typically present in parts per billion, which sounds an amazingly small amount. But even at that level, the components that give flavor to food are effective. So you're trying to separate out the components, separate them and analyze them and identify them. And then the flavorist will be given a bewildering array, sometimes many, many hundreds of components.
Whoa. So when you have that array in front of you and you're going for the peach, what are the tastes that we might not expect to find in that peach?
Well, you'd find a lot of different characters there. Some of them would be things that you would expect, a creamy character which you would associate with peach. But you would also find some meaty characters, some roasted characters, even in fresh peach, which if you smelt them on their own, you would be very hard-pressed to think, wow, that's peach. But they're characters which would give the peach an individual nuance, and in the case of some of the roasted notes, it would be, let's say, the character of peach skin, which people find very, very attractive. One way of describing it is a sort of furry peach.
What's the easiest taste to create?
Well, on the face of it, the very simplest taste would be things like vanilla, which we recognize as having one big component, vanillin. Things like raspberry, where the major component smells of violet. But even there, you have flavors which need to have many, many more elements added in to be realistic. You can't just simply take a few ingredients and blend them together. You don't want to make a flavor too complicated, because then if you draw the analogy to an artist, you're mixing too many colors together and you end up with gray.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a happy midpoint there where it's just complicated enough to be real, but not so complicated that it becomes dull.
Are there certain tricks you can use to turn on people's emotions? Because we associate taste and emotion constantly.
Yes. Emotions have always been something that has been the province of perfumers, and although most companies have perfumers and flavorists working in the same building, they don't always talk as much as they should. And it's only really in recent years that the knowledge of emotions that's derived from the fragrance side, where it's key, has been applied to the flavor side. But it's exactly the same argument. So if you, for example, saw chocolate as calming, you could absolutely accentuate the characters within a chocolate flavor that would give that calming effect at a higher level.
What would it be in chocolate?
Well, the kind of notes that would give you that calming effect would be the heavier, softer, red kind of characters. Chocolate has notes which are very pungent, and they certainly wouldn't be calming, so you'd push those down. you push up things like the vanilla character and some of the heavier notes.
Interesting. This is all very personal, I would imagine. And
it's tremendously personal, and I think in this industry there's not so many of us, and we would almost recognize each other's flavors from the tricks that we have developed over the years. And we may not want to admit that, but I think it's true.
I can see it. Oh, there's John's peach iced tea. I would know it anywhere. John, thanks so much for talking with us.
No, thank you very much. Thank you.
John Wright is a consulting flavorist. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can reach us any way you want. You can join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, actually pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. And until next time, let me leave you with this definition from Anonymous. Vegetarian, an old Native American word for bad hunter. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you can find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear, who is not a Jennifer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Well, we're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.